Blog Talk Radio.
Change things up a bit, making life a little more, I don't know, defined, articulating some of the ideas that float around in lodges, and listening to what you've been saying to the that has impressed me. Yes, it does matter. Ready for the annual communication here in this jurisdiction? I hope you are. It's the expression of the connection with the past. I want to explore today something quite interesting that I've noticed about that whole idea. We have this idea that whatever happened before was the way we want to we want to achieve. Before was better than now. That now we're so dissatisfied with the condition, our conditions, and our state of being, that the sense of an easier, simpler time appeals to us. This isn't just within the framework of Freemasonry, but throughout the environment, particularly you think about simpler times when the dream of having of achieving the middle class for some, or striving to achieve great heights, either academically, hopefully academically, or in the business and market community, selling things, but today. That dream seems to have been challenged quite a bit, in particular because we have the lions of our societies, our culture, being traders, T-R-A-D-E-R. They don't build something, they don't give a service. They don't contribute a brick or a pencil. They are involved in the trade of commodities, of properties, of different elements, and they get rewarded, tremendous rewards for this. Hard today to think that the values of the past are going to help us as we examine. We've ramped up our ability to examine. And we have tools, reliable tools, to examine what's happening around us. And that's given us an opportunity to come up with more answers to more questions. Was ignorance bliss? Well, ignorance was costly. Always has been. And there's too many examples to get over that, but you have to wonder, why do we have that sense that it was better before? Like, really, it's not that we're aliens. This is something that has, and it's not just a phenomena of our time. We see this in writings throughout history that people have yearned for an earlier time because it has had advantages that are lost to the moment. I'm not exactly sure that what we're talking about is in fact anything more than an illusion. We, if we're looking at this question of the earlier times, well, you know, the reality is it wasn't easier, it wasn't simpler. It was, we're making those assumptions based on a very small amount of information, a very small amount. But it's within our nature, as time passes, not to dwell on the pain and suffering, but to filter out the unwanted and the unpleasant and remember the best moments. Imagine if you could live that way for your entire life, particularly in the moment, as a Freemason, as a free thinker, as a Mason, to be able to savor the positives is a choice. Part of that is what I believe Masonry has given us, that exception, given us, is that understanding of the choices that we make that will alter the quality not only of our lives, but of the quality of lives of anybody that comes in contact with us. That's not a matter of arrogance. It's a matter of awareness. Now, when we're to say that it's wrong-minded to be sentimental about the past would be a bit foolish. The past within itself is not necessarily a nobler a time, but it helps us to define ourselves in noble ways. Today, we don't have necessarily a sense of whether we're committing noble deeds. Hindsight will help us to do that. But we live in a different time, a much different time than any other. The amount of science that we have doubles. The amount of science, that's the evidence, doubles every 9 years. Now, the amount of knowledge that we have is accelerating. And that, we would say, is an excellent, it's a good thing. If we're going to dumb down and suggest that we would live be idle-minded, I think that conversation has no place in Masonry. What is interesting is our capacity to examine that phenomena, to examine what is the benefit of work and industry over idleness. My inherited money, inherited attitude. Today, the world has amassed, it is off kilter a bit. The top few percent of people in the world, a very small percentage of people in the world, have amassed the greatest amount of wealth. What does that do at the expense? You know, today, we need to be able to examine, not lull people into the sense that this is the way it is, and we need to accept that because the people that are advantaged are going to continue to want to be advantaged, and they will be defenders of the status quo in spite of the evidence that is more self-serving, and that makes sense to us. You know, if I walk past this apple tree every day and it drops a perfect apple into my hand, I'm going to continue to walk that path because I want that beautiful apple. Of course, I'm not going to be criticizing myself. It's and saying that's wrong. Of course not. But what we're looking at is a different kind of forest. In this forest, a very small group of people live with more than they need. Far more than they need. They do that because they can. Now, our sense, the real harshness for you and me as Masons is to recognize the ethos of common purpose, common cause. This notion itself refuted the sense that I've got mine and to hell with you. Not only is that known attitude in the world today, in some of the most powerful nations of the world, it's been prevalent for a long, long time, since colonial times and before that. Now, we've seen the wreckage left by the colonialist mentality. And we've seen the wreckage left by isolationism. You know, I'll take care of mine and to hell with the rest. It's been wreckage because wisdom has taught us, has exposed us to absorb what the knowledge, what the facts are telling us. Collectively, we do better. That comes as no surprise, brethren. What is a challenge now is whether we can ride out this storm that's on us, the radicalization of attitude, politics, and economics, using 17th, 18th, 15th century ethics. I suggest, some of it, like the idea of common purpose and the common man, absolutely. There are certain philosophies. The idea of Confucianism would help us. Now go and do that. Go and do that research for yourself. I'm not here to be quarrelsome at all. And here, at Masonic Effects, we've looked at the question of how to live a good life from the brilliant writings of La Montagne so many hundreds of years ago, right up to the contemporary. Now, Margaret Macmillan, Dr. Macmillan, one of the most notable, and I'll say it, most notable historians in the face of the earth, whose writings are worth examination, makes us well aware that history can be manipulated. And I think in a way, Masonry is manipulating history today in order to maintain this status quo. There's change that's already happened around us, and the change within the thinking of the organization, but it's just being very shy about coming out. There are thinkers within the organization, and this idea that not all men have joined, it is, when you hear that, it's kind of, I don't know whether it's mean-spirited or just wrong-minded. I didn't join for this reason. Now, when I hear that, I'm reminded of something that I was taught very, very early on. Did I come with preconceived notions? And that's the way the exception was given to me. No preconceived notions, no judgment of my own free will and accord. But for somebody, regardless of their age, their rank, to get up on their hind legs and say, that's not why I joined, seems a little bit peculiar. A little bit peculiar. Now, one of the things we're going to examine here in a couple of weeks is this notion of why some people will clamor to be participants in anything going on, and some will hold back. If you think that's just personality, you'd be wrong. You keep your mind open. We're going to illustrate that whole point. But it happens. The manipulation of history in order to maintain the status quo is not unique to any organization, any single organization. My goodness, no. Let's be a bit more generous in our thinking than that. But Masonry is now facing that opportunity, an opportunity to reframe. Now, this won't happen easily, I suggest. This will be a bit painful, like it always has been. We, in hindsight, might say, you know, that Alexander Pope was brilliant. But at the time, were his notions well accepted? Well, no. Church, state, you know, weighed in. To be angry is to revenge the faults of others on ourselves. Can you imagine? This is a fellow that was born in 1688. Amazing. But we have all are but parts of one stupendous whole, says Pope, whose body nature is, and God the soul. Will the values move forward? Well, I don't think so. Will the values values of the past are just that? They're values of the past. If you and I examine them and find that they have some validity today, we will pick and choose. So we'll be selective about that knowledge. Pride is still aiming at the best houses. Men would be angels. Angels would be gods. Aspiring to be gods if angels fell. Aspiring to be angels, men rebel. Don't you wonder when the poets help express ideas so deeply and so profoundly in ways that has resonance with so many of us? Here, I don't know how many times you've seen this, where poor quality work is being congratulated. Ugh. Praise undeserved is satire in disguise. It's laughable. That's all you can do with it. And to do that, to praise an entered apprentice that you know is capable of better, to never giving that apprentice the opportunity to be pushed, to face the push externally in order to understand his own capability so that he can develop the push and make it striving. He can strive for his best. It's an unfair lesson. It's like saying you're never going to make the big leagues, but you're just wonderful. You're just amazing. Well, if the person has the capability, we want them to be able to examine their own faults. And once you can do that, once you can identify the faults, the problems, then you can work on them. And that's where our experience and our judgment, the wisdom, comes into play. That's how we help the young man, the young person, the young mind, the yearning mind. Does this have only application for boys? Certainly not. We continue intellectually to evolve through the course of our entire life. What are we offering to the man who knocks on our door in the 21st century and has come through an ordeal? Are we sufficiently schooled in our own understanding, our own philosophy, in the principles of Masonry? Okay, it's all right to describe a lodge in terms of the wallpaper. The wallpaper is beautiful. It has interesting forms on it. and all of these forms have meaning. Well, that's the first step, that the things around us have meaning. What we're doing here in Masonic Effects, just like you do, is stand at that Y in the road. One part is, what is all of this saying to us? What is ritual saying to us? And what does it mean? Two things that we're very shy to employ. And I think in the past, I don't know, but from listening, reading the tone of some of the criticisms and works of the past, I get the feeling it was done by very rough men. And that once there was an idea, it had to be defended in a very muscular fashion. I find that curious. Isn't Masonry also known as the gentle craft? Not gentle as in weak. Gentle as in having the capacity to carefully examine. Examining the nuance, examining the filigree of life. But I might digress. Let's have a little bit of a music to pull us together. This is from a 1986 show in the Grand Opera House in Belfast. It's Stefan Grappelli. No longer with us now. And he's playing with Martin Taylor and Lewis Stewart on guitars and Jack Suing on double bass. It's remarkable. It just resonates. We'll come back. We have a little bit more. We have more. I need some help here. Thank you. Music. What can you do? We live in remarkable times, don't we? I think the commentary today is quite fitting, quite apropos. We're meant to discuss and think. A masonry alive and doing fine. That's what I've called us. Who would have thought? Possible to form an organization dedicated to enlightenment, to replacing ignorance with fact, darkness to light. We know the answer is a resounding yes, but in the day, nobody knew. What facts would have told them to given our ancients the ability to predict? What facts? Today, buffeted by the acceleration of science and knowledge in general, masonry is answering the challenge with a challenge of its own. What happens when Masonic tenets and principles embrace the synergy of imagination? Now that the genie, communication, is out of the bottle, all forms of leadership, including Masonic, have undergone careful exam. Aim not at understanding, but satiating a growing cynicism. Success depends on the fruition of genius. Genius is being buffeted on a sea of scientific knowledge that doubles in depth every 9 years. Doubles. We are Masons in these unusual times. Worrying about our future is only a temporary distraction. We are living our future today. We understand doubts about the future are self-generated and unimportant, truly. Masonry is not a goal as such, but it has goals.
We impart knowledge to the entered apprentice to fulfill his abilities as a person of character. To do that, he must understand his nature and his position in the universe. It is as much about a binding process as it is about understanding. Periodically, we have lost track of our aims, only to be brought back to task by dedicated brethren. We seem to be at a watershed moment. The tipping point is an interesting question, not whether we address the contemporary sensibilities, but how we change the narrative to focus on modern and calm the clamor of those who fear loss of identity. If we change, do we really? I think we modernize the language, my goodness. But that's in our working language. That's not in our ritual. Our working language needs to be able to think about the effects of forces around us. We know more about them today, and yet we seem shy about using the tools, those tools of precision. We now have the ability to perform surgery, not just hewing stone out of a quarry. And like any good workman throughout the centuries, of course, using the best, newest techniques and tools was the purpose of the lodge, to impart and share that experience. Was this tool better? Yeah. If it was, our obligation to the guild is quite clear on what we do with it. We're going to, we are going under change, but I want to talk to you more about what happened here in our contemporary, in our situation. I won't say contemporary anymore. That's a word I've used far, far, far too much. I want to talk to you about some people have thought occurred when Masonry came to across the ocean. Does it matter? Well, yeah, it does. When people cross the ocean, we've known this for quite some time. The anthropologists and sociologists have told us this for some time. And for those of you who think we can live in this world without the humanities, I refer you to the train wreck of 2008. And what that did, at Harvard School, whether you think that throwing that kind of money at education is purposeful or just competition, nevertheless, the 2008 did make a change in the way in the course selection for Harvard. Does the humanities matter? Try thinking about living in a world without, just for a moment. And I would think that up at the top of that list of things having to do with the humanities is Masonry. But I want to talk about that movement of ideas. It's ideas. And we sometimes are left thinking that it was because of the military that these ideas were. Military expansion and colonialism was the vehicle. But it wasn't the ingredient that brought Masonry here. There was need here. What is that need? Well, that remains to be seen, I think. The modern Freemasonry of Anderson and de Soglia reached Italy around 1729 when Charles Saxville, the Duke of Middlesex, founded a lodge in Florence together with some Englishmen living there. Henry Mann, Tommaso Crudelli, the first martyr of Italian Freemasonry, he was called. Italy saw the phenomena of Jacobite lodges, established to further the cause of the old and young pretenders. lodges regarded as highly irregular in London and subject to British intelligence activity. This confluence of secret lodges, we're talking about Scotland here. This confluence of secret lodges and foreign intelligence activity appears to have been behind the first papal bull against Freemasonry in 1738. The bull in Eminenti Apostolatus Specula iterated Pope Clement XII's prohibition of any Masonic assembly, forbidding any involvement by Catholics in Freemasonry on pain of excommunication. Many Catholics ignored the prohibition. Anti-Masonic papal bulls issued in 1738 and 1751 went unheeded in independent Venice. In 1728, remember, there is a politics to popes. And you can do your own research, do some research on that. So, you know, we're looking at validation, and this was after the Catholic Church had gone through quite a period of reformation for obvious reasons. 1729, Thomas Howard was the 8th Duke of Norfolk and a prominent Mason, and he visited Venice and Florence. Members of the Florence Lodge also included Antonio Ciocci, personal physician to Theophilus Hastings, the Earl of Huntington, and Abbot Antonio Niccolini. He was an erudite patron of art and literature. Niccolini was on friendly terms with the Prince of Wales and Horace Walpole. He was the fourth son of Robert Walpole, the Earl of Orford. In Venice, Paduan Antonio Conte was an active Freemason. He had met Newton and de Soglia in England, as well as at the Duke of Montague and Chevalier Ramsay, who was at this time showing Venice to Montesquieu. Montesquieu, later initiated in the Horn Lodge in Westminster by de Soglia. Francesco El Gualarte and Schiaponi Fafi were among other prominent citizens in the Republic of Venice who were in contact with the Royal Society in London and the Masonic circles of England and France. According to Montesquieu, Alessandro Benelli Maffi was one of the founders of a lodge in Verona. It can be assumed that when a Venetian Freemasonry then existed as early as 1730s. From the 1730s, English craft masonry was introduced to Belgium, Denmark, France, Germany, Gibraltar, 1728. British troops were there warring with Spain, as well as Holland, Malta, Menorca, Russia, Switzerland, and Turkey. So think of the 1730s as an important period in the development of masonry. Provincial Grand Lodge flourished in Hamburg between 1737 and 1811. It's going on. The reference point for here in Canada would be the War of 1812. Hanover in 1746 to 28, and later in Holland, but not much, in 1756, when the Grand Lodge of England signed a treaty recognizing the sovereignty of the Grand East of the Netherlands in its jurisdiction. The first provincial Grand Master of Russia was appointed in 1731. Though the Provincial Grand Lodge did not come into existence until 1772. It was banned in 1794 under orders from Catherine the Great, alerted by the Russian Orthodox Church, which sensed a spiritual rival. English Freemasonry was introduced into North America by the appointment of Daniel Cox as Provincial Grand Master of New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania in 1730. Henry Price was made Provincial Grand Master for New England in 1733. Between 1730 and 1776, the Premier Grand Lodge of England, as opposed to the ancients, appointed 23 Provincial Grand Masters for parts of what is now the USA. In 1729, Captain Ralph Farr Winter was made provincial Grand Master of the East Indies. The first native Indian recorded to have been initiated into the craft was Amdat ul Umra, Nabob of the Carnatic, in 1775. The first lodge in China was Amity Lodge in Canton in 1767. The provincial Grand Master for Sumatra was appointed in 1796 with two lodges under his charge. In 1730, Ralph Took was made provincial Grand Master for South America. Something of a task, one might think, Grand Master for an entire continent. There were provincial Grand Masters for Antigua in 1738, Barbados in 1740, and the Lodge of Jamaica in 1739. There were three provincial Grand Masters appointed in 1736 for Gambia, the Cape Coast, and the coast of Africa, and the British Islands in America. A great deal seems to have come from alleged meeting at the Apple Tree Tavern in 1716. Some of you will know that that assumption has been challenged. We went on to deal with some of the challenges faced by Masonry, particularly in France being a sophisticated culture, every bit as indexed as that of Britain. And some would say the French language is more poetic, but while the largest number of Freemasons to be found anywhere in the world today are in the United States of America, the case of France is the most important to understand when trying to disentangle the many strands involved in the global proliferation of Masonic ties. French aristocrats, gentry, and learned people took to Freemasonry like the proverbial ducks to water when it became established in that country in 1725. However, the peculiar French talent for innovation, stylistic individuality, philosophy, and sentimental artistry quickly went to work on the Masonic inheritance and led within 40 years to an extraordinary variety of Masonic ritual inventions, several of a distinctly bizarre kind. French successes in colonization and empire building assured that French forms of Freemasonry would find their way around the world, where French originated traditions may still be found in many parts, often in dominant positions, though that is not the case with regard to the stranger kinds of fringe rites. French models of Freemasonry may be categorized as belonging to the following streams. Freemasonry, broadly in line with that ratified by the Grand Lodge of England, currently represented by the National Grand Lodge of France. Chivalric influenced Masonic orders, such as the Ancient and Accepted Rite or Scottish Rite with its 33 degrees, enormously influential in the Americas. Grand Orient Freemasonry, traditionally run by a small body of Masonic oligarchs. Grand Orient Freemasonry has pursued a more or less independent path of Masonic development on account of its removing references to religion from its constitutions. It has stood as an unrecognized body from the point of view of the British Grand Lodges. There has also been a continencing of politically oriented philosophizing within the Grand Orient that has been deemed a deviation from the landmarks respected by British Freemasonry. Freemasonry of the Scottish rectified type. This kind of Freemasonry has a considerably more developed mystical, magical, and philosophical side than craft masonry. Excuse me. It has been linked to the development of a number of strands of continental esoteric thought and development. While its orders are not recognized by the British Grand Lodges, it has been influential in the history of thought, but is often confused with mainstream Freemasonry in a manner that has been used to prejudice consideration of the mainstream movement. Excuse me. 19th century fringe Freemasonry arising out of the appearance of the Theosophical Society in 1875. This movement, that's the fifth variation, this movement includes co-masonry, today represented by Le Droit Humain, an order that permits men and women to meet in Masonic amity to pursue a philosophically and mystically oriented fraternal emphasis. Disagreements between English and French-based co-Masonic authorities have occasionally punctuated its existence. It is difficult to insist on recognized Masonic landmarks when the order has itself deviated from the recognized Masonic model. Internecine bickering and personality inflammation has been a characteristic element of this category of Masonic activity, though such does not characterize all of its members. Nothing boring about Masonry, not a thing. But established in France between 1725 and 1730, Freemasonry grew rapidly, partly due to a fashionable interest in English institutions among the French educated classes. While the Parisian Grand Lodge dominated French Masonry in the 1730s, more exotic forms of Freemasonry began to proliferate across the nation. Let's come back. Okay? Let's come back to that next week when we get together. Exotic forms of Freemasonry. There's absolutely nothing tedious. Now, when you're talking about change to Freemasonry or the status quo, is that what you're talking about? Those divisions, the spread, this wasn't a singularity, and it wasn't a Grand Lodge of England. This was Masonry outside of the constraints of those constitutions. Masonry was growing. Is that, when you're talking about status quo, is that what you're talking about? Well, I'm not really interested in re-examining that bubble. Yes, that was then, and those discussions and those arguments and those debates and that nuance was going on. But I think it's done. Why are we revisiting something that's already passed? I just don't get the value in doing that. What will it teach us? That we're diverse, that there's more than one way of approaching ritual? We know that. But it's not that I'm involved with the Grand Lodge of because of regularity and ignore anything else. This is what I commit. This is the ritual that I follow. You may follow something different. I'm not here to say that you're wrong or I'm right. If this is what's known as regular Masonry, and through that lens, everything else, all others, not at amity, are considered irregular. But remember, do we want to continue with just to ignore? Remember the papal bull, 1738, the Pope comes out and says, you know, you're going to be excommunicated if you remain a Mason. What did they do? When we're going around saying, oh, this is just, you know, terrible, realize that people blew it off. Masons, they continued. But you're looking at the politics of faith, not the faith itself. The leader. Now, today, it's safer for me to talk about that, the separation between organization and the followers, the true followers. Let's separate that out. Not the sheep, not the people that show up because their grandfather did and their father did, and so they feel compelled. Not that bunch. The people that have a sense of the meaning of what they're doing. Is that what you really want to revisit? What's the word for it? Disinclined. Disinclined. Here, I want you to... do we need a little break? No, we'll plunge on here. I want to share with you a small article by, a very clever writer. His name is Oliver Berkman. And this is a question, and I love it because he puts his ideas out as questions. Ever wondered why getting something you want is never enough? The secret is that the quest is the real reward. The first time I went on a silent meditation retreat a few years back, I was terrified the experience might prove impossible to endure. The last time I went, the other week, I faced a different problem. I was pretty sure it would be deeply enjoyable and refreshing. You might be wondering why that counts as a problem. It was on the other evening one day, watching the sun sink below the horizon, savoring the stillness of the air, that I first it occurred to me, damn it, only a few more days of this and it'll be time to leave. According to a cheesy old saying, there are only two ways to be unhappy. One is not getting what you want. The other is getting it. The trouble with happiness is that the prospect of it ending makes you sad. Was it a good location to be entertaining such thoughts? Since this insight is most commonly attributed to Buddhism and meditation, that can help. But the same point crops up in multiple traditions. There's more to wanting than meets the eye. You think the solution to wanting something is to obtain that thing, whereupon you'll feel satisfied. But it rarely works out that way. Either the thing fails to live up to your expectations, or alternately, it does, and then you're desperate not to lose it. Worse, what you're really sometimes craving isn't the thing itself, but novelty. And by definition, you can't keep obtaining that from the same person or possession. In a recent essay, Getting What We Want Isn't What We Really Want, David Kane recalled the bittersweet experience of buying new CDs as a teenager. Every glorious listen came with a faint streak of dread because I knew it was only sucking the magic out of it with each play. Clearly, the problem here isn't really the specific things you want but don't have. Rather, it's something to do with the phenomena of wanting. Recent work by neuroscientists Jak Panksepp and Robert Sapolsky suggests that the brain's reward and mechanisms are designed to give us squirts of dopamine, not when we get what we want, but when we pursue it. We're chemically rewarded for maintaining a state of unfulfillment. From an evolutionary angle, this isn't a shock. Constant restlessness is a better recipe for propagating your genes than contentment. And consumerism exacerbates the situation. The biggest profits come not from fully satisfying your customers, but making sure they never stop seeking. According to some hardcore Buddhists, the answer is to transcend desires entirely. A more immediately practical option is simply to keep in mind that wants can be misleading. It always seems as if it's the next delicious meal, career choice, or relationship that will finally deliver, as Kane puts it, the experience of ease and unfettered enjoyment. Yeah, it's always the next, isn't it? It's a false promise. In fact, there's far more ease to be had by understanding our wants rather than scrambling to relieve them. Ah. What you really want is to get proficient at questioning your wants. About wraps up our program for today. I hope you found it contributed to the cause. I hope you liked it, and I hope you'll come back soon. Thank you for your support. It's much appreciated. If you think that this would be of some value to new members of our order, please pass on the word. There's room in Masonic Effects. We're not really creating any of this. This is an ongoing conversation that I think has been happening for hundreds of years. You and I have the pleasure and the honor of participating in it. And in Masonic Effects, we're looking at developing new attitudes from ideas. So I look forward to seeing you again real soon. Thanks for your patience with us. It's here, check this out a little bit. This is Carol Wellsman. Bye for now. Oh yeah, she's Canadian.
By the time I get to Phoenix,
does a good job with this too.
He'll be right.
We want to think about our brethren in France this week after the tragedy.
Find the note I left him.
If you ever need an argument for the purpose of Freemasonry, our headlines are full of reminders.
And he'll laugh.
Keep the faith, brethren.
When he reads the part that says I'm leaving.
It's always a test for good men.
'Cause I've left that man so many times.
Just to fight back.
Before.
Start the peaceful dialogue so that there can be an understanding. Men put down their weapons.
By the time I make Albuquerque, he'll be working. He'll probably stop for lunch and give me a call. But he I really go.